Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and I want to read you something. It's the opening sentence of Adam Gopnik's latest article in The New Yorker. Of all the amazing things the mind does, the most amazing may be that it can take sound and turn it into music, and then take music and turn it into meaning. I mean, think of that for a minute. A bunch of sounds put together isn't just a bunch of sounds anymore. It becomes something. Something you can feel, even if you can't explain it in words. And sometimes, even the people creating the music don't know what it means, until later. Check out this moment with singer Jen Grant.
We were carrying on, oh, we used to be so strong. Never knew who we were living in the beautiful wild. In the beautiful wild.
What or who is this song about?
I'm not sure if I knew who it was about when I was writing it, but we made a video after the album was finished, and I used a lot of footage of my mom from 1973. We found that this 16mm footage of her after she passed away, because she died this year. So I think that for me, this song is about her.
Seeing you in the scenes of an old time movie.
Now, how does that happen? How does a piece of music take on meaning, and how does it do it without its creator even realizing it? We'll talk to Jen Grant and hear her band playing live in just a bit, but these are big questions, elemental questions about music and how we humans as a species make and understand music. They might even be unanswerable questions, but that didn't stop Adam Gopnik, staff writer at The New Yorker, from tilting at these particular windmills, and he joins us to tell us what he's learned. Adam, good to have you back with us.
Wonderful to be back.
This is an ambitious article, taking on some of the most fundamental ways in which we interact with music. It seems to have begun just with you looking at how your teenage kids...
There were kind of two elements, to be honest. One I don't even mention in the piece, which is that I've been engaged for the past 3 years in writing a musical, a piece of musical theater with the great composer David Shire. And one of the things that fascinated me as a writer was that David Shire spoke this language of music the way I speak English. He just spoke it as a language. You say, write something sad, he wrote something sad. Write a Ravel waltz, he wrote it. And I began to think, what is this thing? Because it means so much to me, as I think to everybody. My whole life, in a sense, is composed of pieces of music. How does it work? What's the underlying grammar? And then exactly as you say, I also noticed that my kids, I have a 13-year-old and an 18-year-old, as many people know, though totally wrapped up in music. My son is a guitar player, far better than I ever was, had a totally different relationship to music than I did growing up. I grew up with the LP, the album, side one, side two, put your head between the two speakers and share your fans, did you hear what's on Pink Floyd? And they snatch at music all the time, constantly engaged with it, but on earbuds, on those horrible tinny speakers on their computers. And I would say, I can't listen to this on that lousy speaker on your computer. And they would give me this, once again, this weird look. That is to say, Dad, you are so weird look. So I wanted, from both those reasons, to understand what makes music a natural language that some people are expert at speaking, and how has it changed so that our experience of music, my experience of music generationally, is so different from my kids.
Right. So the idea that you can't listen to music that you might actually like because it's coming out of your kids' teeny little computer speakers, you know, that speaks to the fallacy of this march of progress. We have this kind of linear, you know, first sound quality was poor, then it got better, then we had stereo, then we had digital, and it keeps getting better and better. It's not how it works at all.
Not how it works. The first and sort of central thing that remained in the process of my getting educated about this is exactly that we listen with our minds, not with our ears. One of the most dramatic examples of this, which was brought to my attention by Edgar Chiweri, a Princeton engineer who became the hero of this piece, is that there's a famous experiment around the First World War at Carnegie Hall, actually, where they had a soprano singing in the dark and then played in the dark Victrola, one of those old RCA Victrolas, which we listen to now with a big smile on our face because it sounds so scratchy and so tinny. And it was the same then. And everybody in the audience couldn't tell the difference between them.
Right.
So they were willing themselves to believe in the fidelity of the best sound reproduction system they had at that time.
Those are the famous Edison tests.
Exactly, exactly.
There is some thinking that he had hired sopranos who could specifically kind of recreate a tinnier sound. But still, the point is...
It's startling. And certainly throughout the history of recorded sound, at any one moment, everyone says, oh, my God, it sounds like the thing is right in the room. It could be a Monoral 78.
Right, right.
It could be, you know, a hi-fi Le Mans, the 24 Hours of Le Mans in 1965.
So, I mean, you know, on the one hand, this is not rocket science. On the other hand, Edgar Schaueri is a rocket scientist.
Honest to God, rocket scientist. How many times in your life do you meet somebody who's an honest to God rocket scientist, has an enormous lab at Princeton filled with rocket engines? He's invented a new kind of rocket engine, an electric engine, basically, with, as we say, a very long extension cord. And that's what he does. But he's passionate, fascinating guy, passionate about music, particularly about the choral works of Bach. The Mass in B minor for him is the summa, the apex of all human activity, maybe quite rightly. And he always has felt that there was something disturbing about the reality that we could only hear it in two dimensions emerging from our speakers. And he made it his task in life to find a way to give us three-dimensional sound.
Now, there have been numerous attempts at this over the years. I mean, Brian Eno in the mid-70s just sort of accidentally discovered that by incorrectly wiring a third speaker, he could sort of simulate a 3D.
That's right. And as Elvis had 56 speakers in his plane, the Lisa Marie, running all the way around. So it's kind of – but that's surround sound of a sort.
Yeah,
and what
Schaueri
was interested in was actually producing sound where the speakers would, so to speak, seem to go dead. You wouldn't be hearing sound from the speakers. The sound would seem to be in the room with you, to your right, to your left, behind you, in front of you.
So you did this.
I went to visit him, absolutely.
And what song did you choose?
Well, I just had my little iPod, and I am a big Rolling Stones fan. The only reason I don't weigh 300 pounds is because the Stones keep me going on the stationary bike day after day. So I just sort of at random picked out Beast of Burden, Stones classic. And Edgar Schaueri said, oh, yeah, okay. And he had this little box, like the kind of magic box you see in a movie or in a weird science box, let's call it. And he plugged it into my little iPod as it was playing Beast of Burden. And suddenly, it was three-dimensional. I don't mean it had more dimensionality, but it was really in the room with me.
That's the Rolling Stones' Beast of Burden, as we've all heard it for so many years. Adam Gopnik, in your article for The New Yorker, you write about suddenly, through Edgar Schaueri's magic box, hearing it a completely different way.
He, in the box is what he calls his Bach filter, and after Joan Sebastian, and he plugged it in, and suddenly, there it was, Keith Richards is stabbing away with a cigar in his mouth, could practically hear, on my right, and Ronnie Wood was, you know, plucking away in that kind of syncopated way he does. But Ronnie was standing to my left. Keith was to my right. Mick Jagger was somewhere right in front of me. And Charlie Watts impassively was keeping time right behind my head. I had been inserted into the center of the Stones. It was a startling, uncanny experience.
Now, were you simply reliving the same experience those people at Carnegie Hall had 100 years ago when they heard the tinny little, you know?
This is a deep question. This is a very big question. And, of course, it's a question we can never answer at any one time. In other words, will 10 years from now, will my experience be as laughable in some way as the Carnegie Hall experience? And another fascinating part of it is when the Stones recorded that, of course, they didn't record it with Keith standing here and Ronnie standing here and Charlie behind. They recorded over 2 weeks or 3 months. One track at a time when none of them were speaking to each other and they were all standing in front of mics. One of the things Schaueri points out is that our entire corpus of sound from the stereo era, because it was recorded with more than one mic, has sort of residual, latent in it, the possibility of three-dimensionality, even though it was never meant for that. He has a lovely illustration, said it's though every feature film for the past 50 years had been filmed for some other reason with two cameras, and therefore latent in it was the possibility of 3D.
Right. So you can transfer any stereo recording into a kind of three-dimensional aspect.
Exactly. Thanks to this Bach filter, the magic Bach filter.
And it basically comes not from perfection, but from the exact opposite.
Yes, it's a very interesting thing, and it is way at the outer edge of my technical understanding or expertise. But basically, what he's done is to solve a problem involving what's called crosstalk cancellation, the reality that your right ear hears what the left ear is supposed to hear, and vice versa.
So if you have two speakers, one left, one right, your right ear is not just hearing the right speaker, it's hearing something from the left speaker, and vice versa.
Right, and our sense of dimensionality comes out of that separation. One of the things that Chouari points out is all you have to do is put a mattress between two speakers and press your nose against it, and you will get a startlingly robust 3D effect.
He's talking about standing a mattress on end.
Right, and as he points out, this is very robust until your wife comes home, and then it ceases to be a very robust way of getting that effect. So what he's done is to create a computer program, an algorithm that does this, and it involves basically the complicated psychological truth that we are very, very poor judges. Human beings are very poor judges of tiny differences in time, but we're incredibly acute to differences in tone. So the distortion of tone that takes place in the course of this happening is very, we notice right away. So if the piano goes a little bit off, we'll hear it as a xylophone and we'll hate it. But if you, at a very microscopic level, if you change how fast it's coming at you, that's something we don't notice. That's one of the things we don't notice. And so he's sort of played on that asymmetry in order to create these effects. Now, and deeper than that, I don't understand it.
Okay. We're speaking with Adam Gopnik, who, however much of his own article he understands, has written a really amazing piece for The New Yorker, his story on the quest for the ultimate audiophile experience, 3D recording, and really leading him to the much more basic questions of what it all means. It's in the this week's issue of the magazine. Now, on the New Yorker website, there is this kind of thing you can our listeners can go on the website right now and do this. Explain what this kind of speaker experiment is.
Edgar Chouari very graciously helped us at the New Yorker because we wanted to demonstrate. And it's one of the, you know, with all the deficits of the new digital age, there are some terrific pluses. And one of them is when you're writing a piece about 3D sound, you can show your readers what 3D sound is like. So we put a couple of things up that show even without any special equipment, what this experience is like. So if you just get your head stationed between two speakers, the most ordinary speakers, those little speakers that you might have attached to your computer, you can have the experience of dimensional sound.
Let's hear a little bit. This is from the version on the NewYorker.com's website. That's a little bit of the song Phrases by Jamie Haddad, Mark Sherman, and Lenny White from their record Explorations in Space and Time. And
Built into the piece, and it's very important. And it's wonderful. In a sense, though, you don't get the effect as powerfully as you do when you're listening to Beast of Burden or the Mass in B minor, in the sense that it's sort of transformational, right? Something you're very accustomed to hearing. And a piece like that is layered and built to be dimensional. But
I should also point out what we just heard was the speaker version on NewYorker.com.
Right.
There's also a headphone
version. Complicated thing about how headphones tend to revert into the center of your head, which Edgar spent several days explaining to me why that happens. But this really astonishing thing about the 3D sound, as Chuari has done it, is that you have these amazing moments when you're listening to stereo and suddenly the speakers go dead and the sound is in the room with you. And the single most astonishing thing about it is you have this amazing and now well-documented, it's not a willed thing, relaxation response. And Chuari's explanation of it says, we have been listening to stereo sound for 50-some years as exactly in the same way that we would be watching a 3D movie without glasses. You know that moment when you're at the 3D movie and you take your glasses off? It gives you a headache. And that's the way we've been experiencing stereo sound. So for him, more important even than the purity of the reproduction, the fidelity of it, is the feeling that you get inside. And I must testify, it's very profound.
Mm. It's also very specific to a little spot in the room. So
that's the catch. That's the catch. It's this tiny sweet spot that it can't work, this kind of thing, except in it's bigger now. The sweet spot gets bigger all the time, but it's still a relatively small spot. You got to be one of those guys who sits in his living room, and it is mostly guys, sits in his living room on the sweet spot listening to it. And there's something deeply pathetic and limited about that activity.
Like the guy in the old Maxell ad.
Exactly.
Sitting
exactly.
in his chair with his hair blowing back.
Exactly.
Speakers
so.
In front of him. We're speaking with Adam Gopnik, staff writer for The New Yorker, about his article on three-dimensional sound and why and how we as humans take sound. And actually, you were talking before about you writing this music theater piece with David Shire, how David speaks this language of music. Even more amazing is that those of us who don't speak that language still understand it when it is spoken to us.
It's, I think, the single most astonishing thing in the realm of human experience is that we have these abstract sounds, vibrations in the air, and we experience them as the most core emotional map of our lives, as though somebody were writing quadratic equations up on a blackboard at one end of Carnegie Hall. So I must see this. I got to watch this. And tears come to your eyes and your heart beats harder. It's the most astonishing thing that that happens. So having talked to Chuari and learned so much about it, I still recognize that his question was a question of reproduction,
right,
of fidelity. It really wasn't a question of why. Why is it that the Mass in B minor moves this engineer so profoundly? Why is it that the Stones keep me moving all the time? Why is it that music is the most powerful emotional language that exists on Earth? So I went up to McGill University, which is my alma mater, but curiously
in
enough,
Montreal.
In Montreal, in Canada, but coincidentally and curiously enough, has become a kind of center for research into the psychology of music, people asking the question, why? Why do we like music? Why does it speak to us so deeply? What goes on in our heads when we listen to it?
And McGill is where our old friend Dan Levitin works.
Exactly, one of the leaders in the field.
Dan was on our show just the other day talking about apparently a very lighthearted segment about like musical red flags in a relationship when you like one kind of music and your intended hates it or vice versa. And, you know, his point was there is a serious, music becomes a part of how we see ourselves. It's like our personal narrative, a reflection of who we are.
Well, one of the things that makes Dan such an engaging guy, as well as being an excellent scientist, is that he's a musician. He speaks the language of music. He worked as a commercial producer for a long time. So he's not coming to it from outside. He's coming to it very much from inside.
Now, you spoke with Dan about his pretty well-known study of the expressive piano.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what that is and how it works into your narrative here.
Levitin has a laboratory, which, as I say in the piece, a little like something out of Gulliver's Travels, like Academy of Lagoda, because he has this super painful thing where you stick your arm in a icy bath and then you look at an attractive woman and you see how the music changes as you experience it. One of the things he's done is they have this piano and they had a classical pianist enter, play a Chopin piece, which the piano.
This is a digital piano.
Digital piano, acoustic piano, but with an electronic assist. Then what they were able to do, and they sort of had to hand feed in this algorithm, was to randomize all of the elements that make piano playing expressive, rubato, and how hard you play, how you pedal, all of those things, the little tiny microscopic changes in rhythm and in note duration that make music expressive. And then they could randomize it so people could listen to it without knowing which one was the intentional thing made by the musician and which one was just made by the computer. And what was astonishing, or maybe not astonishing, is that everybody ranked it alike. In other words, the one that was played by the classical musician, which had a kind of optimal middle of rubato, of tremolo, of vibrato, all of those expressive features was the one that everybody from very different backgrounds preferred.
So if you had this piece played back on this digital piano in perfect rhythm and every note perfectly played, that was inexpressive. But if you went the other extreme, where everywhere you sort of lose the thread of the rhythm because it's so much rubato, people didn't like that either.
Exactly. And, you know, you could say, well, duh, right?
Yeah.
People don't like it very mechanical, and they don't like it very schmaltzy either. We sort of know that. But what's beautiful about the work that Levitin does and the other people in this field is they really know it now. You and I could stand there and say, oh, that must be the case, but we don't know that that's the case. Now they truly know that that's the case.
And once again, we come back to this idea of imperfection in music. If the piece is perfect, we don't respond to it.
Right. That's kind of the underlying theme of this whole study for me, is that error is essential. That one of the things that tells human beings that other human beings are doing this is the presence of error. Now, if it's simply gross error, it's bad. And if it's hyper-subtle error, then we can't notice it. But there's this funny kind of dimension that people seem to have implanted in them where they recognize meaningful and expressive error. And we recognize it across a whole range of things. It's why we love Matisse, for instance. It's because the marks aren't perfect. But it's uncanny how beautifully and exquisitely calibrated our grasp of meaningful error is when we listen to music.
Now, so for much of your article, it seems like, you know, there has been this kind of steady progress in our understanding of sound, of music, of how we interact with it, and our ear has become, or our brain has become, so finely tuned to the nuances of music, whether we realize it or not. And then you meet Jonathan Stern at McGill, who adds a kind of dissenting voice,
it seems. Yes, Jonathan is a sociologist of music, really. I don't know if he'd embrace that description, but that's what he is. And he and a whole group of people with whom he works and do what are called sound studies, the way we do cultural studies, say, they emphasize the community role of music. They emphasize the historical dimension of music. One of the things that Stern loves to point out is that though we have a myth of ever-improving fidelity, the truth about the history of recorded sound is it gets worse and worse all the time. It gets lossier and lossier. And one of the things engineers have made happen is that they've discovered how little signal you have to put into recorded sound, as with the MP3, mm-hmm. most famously, and still have it sell, still have it work perfectly well, because our minds are very good at filling in the blanks.
So you remember when the first digital LPs came out, mm-hmm. and especially if you were a classical music fan, right. They'd have like these Philadelphia RCA Red Seal, Philadelphia Orchestra, yep. digital recording, you know, the latest technology. And when you say lossy, basically what it was a loss of lots of frequencies that they just figured, we don't hear them, and
we don't need them. And we don't need them partly because, as I say, our minds are good at filling in blanks, but also because we are creatures of communities. We are creatures of competitions. And if something is new, we like it for its newness. Mm. And more important, Stern makes a very profound point, I think, which is that our Western habit, in which my piece is premised, your show in a sense is premised, that music listening is an activity independent of our broader social experience, is a very recent and narrow one. Plain English, most people in the history of the world would never understand the difference between listening and dancing. You listen to music in order to dance. And, you know, the way that my kids listen to music, in a sense, is the way the world listens to music. They snatch at music. They incorporate it into their daily social communal experience.
So it's not an abstract thing divorced from the thread of their life. It's a part of it.
That's right. And for the vast history of humanity, music-loving humanity, this business of sitting in a hall, in a seat, uncomfortably, staring straight ahead and listening and giving your neighbor a dirty look if they dare to cough, and that is extremely aberrant. That's the aberrant experience. What my kids are doing, what most people do, is the normal experience. And it doesn't depend on perfect fidelity or even particularly good fidelity.
Right. And with MP3s, you sort of come almost full circle back to, you know, the age-old question of music as an individual experience versus a communal one, because you put earbuds in and it's an individual experience. On the other hand, you know, if you're in the room with your brother and he's doing the same yep. thing, and you know,
and the kids are constantly sharing, and that's why they have all of these illegal sites for file sharing. And I think that that's true. I think that's true. And I think the good thing about studying the sociology of music is that it reminds you that we are creatures live in history and live mm-hmm. in time, and the things that we think are natural are usually artificial in some way, are usually produced.
So let me ask you, Adam. Jonathan Stern at McGill does appear to be, as I said before, a kind of dissenting voice in this yes. piece. Is he really? Or is what he's saying simply, you know, another side of the same coin that Edgar Schoueri and Dan Levitin are showing you?
Obviously, I'd like to think that it can all be synthesized. And at the very end of the piece, I hope, more through evocation than argument, to suggest why. I think the thing you learn from talking to this whole range of people who care about music and study it to some degree academically, scientifically, is that music is a sequence of moments. That is, at any time you think about your experience of music, it's inseparable from the totality of what was happening to you, from the totality of the experience, whether it's listening to Leonard Bernstein conduct Brahms at Carnegie Hall or listening to the Beatles on Christmas morning in 1966. It's that, the density of that moment, that you really respond to. And if you think about the greatest music critics who've ever lived, George Bernard Shaw, very rarely writes abstractly about Wagner. He writes about the totality of the experience mm-hmm. of Wagner. And I think that that's always the way we internalize music, always the way we experience it. And any attempt to separate out our ears from our minds from our histories, will always fail. Music exists in all those dimensions at once.
It's a great place to leave it. Adam, great to speak with you. Thanks so much.
Wonderful to be back. Thanks.
This is Soundcheck. Adam Gopnik is a staff writer for The New Yorker. You can find links to his story called Music to Your Ears, The Quest for 3D Recording and Other Mysteries of Sound on our website. It's a great read. While you're there, you can also test out 3D sound for yourself on speakers or on headphones, all at soundcheck.org. We just heard Adam mention George Bernard Shaw and how he described the music of Richard Wagner. Here's a bit of Forest Murmurs from Wagner's Siegfried, part of the so-called Ring Cycle.